Regcast.
Welcome to Regcast,
where we shine a light on banking digitization.
Hello and welcome to Regcast. I'm PJ, CEO and founder of JWG. Welcome back if you're one of the couple hundred that have already listened to one of our episodes, and welcome if you're first time here with Regcast. This is where we shine a light on the key pain points for the regulatory system and how regulators, regulated, and technology companies can come to grips with this decade's changes. Up to date, we have the regulatory upheaval and the digital plans and opportunities courtesy of a case study from the UK. And we're all based here in the UK, so we have an excellent perspective. But I think as we covered in our last podcast, it's not just about the UK's regulatory system right now. Everybody's revisiting how are they overseeing financial services. ESMA has got a wholesale replacement. BaFin has had its challenges. Australia's up. The US is up. So we thought it would be great to shine a light on what are the critical decisions that UK PLC is looking at and how are those playing out almost in real time. I'm really pleased to introduce our expert panelists again. We have Rachel from senior editor at Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence. Welcome.
Hi.
We have Sam Tyfield, who's a partner at Shoesmiths. Welcome, Sam.
Morning. Thank you, PJ.
And Gavin, thanks very much for joining us from Grant Thornton, and a former regulator who's taking a day off to be with us.
Hi, everyone.
Oh. Guys, if laws are like making sausages, I'm really not sure what the analogy is for making a regulatory framework. There's an awful lot that's being discussed in the public domain, and given the transparent nature of the way laws are made here, we get to see a lot of sausage in process. Andrew Bailey actually said in his testimony, which we'll link to the podcast, that the machine was broken. And that, you know, as the Treasury Select Committee went through the findings of the Gloucester report and looked at a number of the underlying issues, a lot of it gets down to volume, and it gets down to the data available to be able to oversee a very complex system. And in parallel to this technical review of the future of regulatory framework that's coming up, we also have a Prime Minister's commission that's being led by Ian Duncan Smith, and Rachel's covered a lot of those articles as well, which we'll link to the podcast for viewers at home. I think the key question for me is to start with is, what does it really mean to fix this broken machine? And is this whole future of regulatory framework really going to change the rules of engagement between the firms, its customers, and the regulator? So, Gavin, I'd like to turn to you first. What are the choices that regulators have made in the past? It's been part of them you've lived through. And how do you think the digital model questions are really being addressed in the near term?
Okay, so I think it's probably worth going back to the FCA's objectives as a starting point. So you've got market integrity, you've got consumer protection, and you've got competition. There's lots of wording around each of those. But essentially, they're all kind of market-based. They don't directly talk about firms, but we all know that firms are the mechanism through which we experience financial services, and they're the things that tend to go wrong. So there's an automatic tension there between what do you do that's market-based and what do you do that's firm-based. There's also, I think I'd argue, and this will probably make me unpopular in some regulatory circles, that actually there's a genuine tension between the competition and the consumer protection objectives. And so what you have always is how do we distribute our resources across all the firms we have to regulate? There used to be 13,000 of those when the FSA was formed 20 odd years ago. That was doubled in 2005 when Morgan and General Insurance regulation came in to 26,000. Then it was broadly doubled again when consumer credit came in 2014. So what you have is a model that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The FCA, the FSA before it, by definition, needs to have a risk-based approach because you have to make choices. But the tail of smaller firms has got longer and longer, and particularly with consumer credit coming in, there's quite a lot of potential and real problems in that tail. And it's very hard to spot and deal with those problems effectively if you don't have great systems, which we know the FCA, and neither did the FSA, the FCA doesn't have. That's plain from the testimony. So there's lots of tensions in there. And I think that's why the model you know, you can argue that it's broken. I think consumer credit was always likely to do this just because of the nature and profile of the firms involved.
Yeah, great point. And I think we touched on this at the last podcast in terms of that swing of market oversight, especially with all the Reddit punters out there and people piling into GameStop. Sam, I remember you arguing quite convincingly that the retail was actually going to be getting a lot more focus in the future. What do you think this expansion of the regulatory framework means?
I think it means that we need more than one regulator. The one regulator model doesn't work. And I'm a regular and vocal critic of the FCA, but in actual fact, I don't think the system as such is, or the machine as such is broken. It's just not fit for purpose. Most of these firms that are regulated by the FCA will be help desk managed. They don't have individual contact managers who understand their business and to whom or with which they can make contact and say, can I just run something past you? I've got an issue. I've got a problem.
It's 99%+. So it's a big number, massive.
It's most of them. And that goes to the tail, you know, to the one-man bands, to the IFAs, to all the credit consumer. I think the FCA is fighting a losing battle here. This is something I've always said, is we need to make sure that we keep separate retail and wholesale, because they are fundamentally different beasts.
Yeah.
And depending on how you slice it or where you slice it, one regulator gets the wholesale boys and girls, and one or more regulators get retail, consumer credit, peer-to-peer lending, IFAs, all of them, what Gavin refers to eloquently as the tail.
That's a huge statement. What's your view? And based on all the things you've been covering the last few years within the FCA and their change programs, does that make sense to you?
Well, I having more than one regulator is something that has crossed my mind over the last couple of months. You see in the States, for example, they have loads of different regulators. And they're pretty effective. So you've got the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau that covers all the kind of consumer credit, consumer financing angles. And they do a huge amount of enforcement and redress, even under the Trump administration. And I expect that to be ramped up. You've got the SEC, the CFTC, you've got the DOJ, the OCC. They're all very active regulators out there, you know, being pretty aggressive with firms and getting a lot done. You know, back to the UK, I don't know if that's a model for the UK. I do wonder if more regulators makes more problems.
There's the potential for people to fall through the cracks.
Yeah,
we've had the in the US, is are you under the CFT or under the SEC? And if neither claims jurisdiction over you, then you will know one.
Yeah.
So I'm going to add to my idea, which is that you have the regulator of the perimeter, whereas if you don't fall squarely within one of the buckets, you have to toddle off to the perimeter regulator, who then decides what you are.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one thing we haven't mentioned in the mix of this tail of firms is the crypto firms. I don't think there are a huge amount of them at the moment who are actually FCA authorized, but I think that's a real knowledge gap that's could potentially pose a problem down the line. But just in terms of whether the FCA can manage this long tail of firms or supervise this long tail of firms. You know, they've had tools over at their disposal over the years that haven't been massively effective. One was the FCA register, where there were a lot of mistakes. People would go to look at you know, look up a firm and they couldn't find it or the information was outdated. So that was a problem and they redid that. I can't remember if we touched on this in the last podcast, but there's this whole process they've had about information gathering during the pandemic, sending out an email survey to firms to gauge their financial resilience. This is sort of an add-on to or a supplement to their what had been the Gabriel regulatory reporting system to allow them to gather more real-time information. And this is something that Gavin and I have spoken about kind of off camera. And that hasn't been hugely effective. A lot of people didn't respond, including 1,500 credit firms, consumer credit firms that Gavin highlighted. And also they had a problem implementing the Reg Data platform, which is the replacement to the Gabriel, which is, you know, sucking in all the regulatory reports from these long tail of firms. I don't know how that's been going, but it's only halfway rolled out, is my impression. So the Gabriel system and the Reg Data system are running simultaneously at the moment.
And of course, Rachel, one of the Gloucester report recommendations was all about how to get a completely new system in. Right? And to be able to get that on supervisors' desks. And I guess I wanted to turn to Gavin here, because I guess from your perspective, Gavin, I mean, that's always been a bugbear, right? Getting supervisors to be more data centric and operating in an environment where they need these controls. I mean, are we, based on what we're hearing in all these consultations and the papers being written, you know, are we fundamentally flying blind into a post-COVID economy here? I mean, do we have the data we need to be able to manage this as a regulator?
Well, I don't think it's any worse than it has been previously. So there's always been when supervisors ask firms to report, that's a snapshot in time. It gets cleaned up, sent to the regulator. So you're already looking at historical reporting. So when you want to go deeper as a regulator, you talk to the firms directly, you get real-time management information. Sometimes you ask them for specific bits, specific things you're interested in. Supervisors on the whole prefer to look at the MI the firms produce themselves, because they can have better conversations with the senior management, because the CEO and the chair and so on will recognize that data. Whereas if you present them with reporting data that's come into you, quite often it's defined differently, it looks different, they don't recognize it, and you waste time. So, I mean, we've talked about digital reg reporting and greater precision and things that are, you know, machine readable and executable and so on. And I think that would change the whole landscape, because you'd have much more precision, you'd have much less of an apples and oranges problem and so on and so forth. But we are a long way from that.
Yeah.
So what happens in a crisis is that the supervisors talk to the firms much more actively and much more frequently.
I think I completely agree with that. I just wonder whether we could even make it even more useful by focusing the machine readable, I don't want to call it a tick box, but...
Definitely don't call it that.
It's not a tick box. But essentially, if you have to have a yes or no binary answer to something in order to produce a useful result, you don't have a free field, because a free field is interpretable, then we should focus our attention on which firms or which groups of firms should be providing machine readable responses to regulatory surveillance, and those which need a free field. I'm going to wave the flag of wholesale versus retail again, and referring back to a conversation that we've had offline about identifying risk. Now, usually, Gavin, as you have said correctly, risk is usually identified with size. You know, we recognize as a market that complexity, irrespective of size, is also a risk. But you know, there are a huge number of very simple firms, or in their business model, which are small, which gathered together could provide a risk to the stability of the markets. And that is the group, that tail is the group that probably are the best candidates for a machine readable reporting type.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there is something about firms. I mean, you had this with the secondary banking crisis in the early 90s, where, you know, firms with a particular business model, who were, no, you know, who were all banks, and when, you know, there was the kind of Black Wednesday and interest rates went through the roof, et cetera, there was a whole crisis where a group of firms were all susceptible in the same way to a particular set of events that turned out to happen. So we're definitely going through something like that with the pandemic. And I think that's the root of the kind of 4,000 odd firms that the FCA has identified as being particularly at risk in terms of, you know, in terms of their solvency.
And even the GameStop episode shows us that there is some connection between that tail and the firms in the fat end of the yeah. tail as well.
Yeah, I'd just be a little bit, if I may, I'd just be a little bit kind of cautious about a clean wholesale retail split. In my experience, it's pretty hard to identify. And you go back to the financial crisis, there's quite a lot of flow through from, you know, retail mortgages and, you know,
but it is by intermediaries, isn't it? It is not yeah. only as a retail mortgagor. I've got a mortgage. I can't toddle off to the wholesale market and collateralize my mortgage or sell it down. I go through an intermediary. I may actually go through a number of intermediaries to the wholesale market. We should be able to draw a line somewhere where at some point the aggregation of retail interests becomes sufficient that the person managing those, I use managing in the non-specific yeah. permission sense, is then wholesale.
I think all I'm saying is you have to have the bridges and sort of look across. So if I take a really kind of crude example, but it's a real one, when the FSA divided into wholesale and retail business units in 2004. Barclays was in the retail business unit because of its retail, you know, big UK retail bank, but it meant that Barclays Capital was there as well. Yeah, and so it wasn't on the wholesale side. Discuss, you know. So, you know, you have to be able to look across, you have to have the bridges and so on. None of this is easy. No. And I think your point about falling down between the gaps is really pertinent. And even something like, I'm just thinking of an example, something like structured deposits,
yeah,
where you kind of have a big wholesale element in what's ostensibly a retail product. So yeah, you have to go specific and also broad at the same time, and that's the crux of the whole problem.
And then that's a nice segue back to a question that PJ asked a while ago, which is, you know, my soapbox about the world is going to change for retail. So as part of that discussion, Gavin, I think we're going to have to think about what products and services should be available to retail or should incorporate retail interests in them, irrespective of, you know, the reams of paper that I can send a retail investor or a retail customer about the risks and the benefits and the upsides and whether it's suitable for them. Should, and I posit the question, I don't have a view. Should retail investors be allowed to trade CFDs or fractional shares in the volumes that we saw with GameStop and, yeah. and the rest of them? Does that solve the problem?
Well, and Rachel, let's come back to you on that, because I think this is very much a political decision, really not one for the regulators themselves. How do you see that oversight evolving, especially, you know, now that the UK has exited and has got its own framework. There's a lot of interesting questions here that I've heard you talk about at length. What's the crux of the issue, and how do we oversee the watchers of the regulatory framework itself?
Well, I think that politically, the response to GameStop hasn't involved anything regarding limiting retail investors' access to trading certain products. When it comes to CFDs and binary options, those kind of things, the approach regulators take in the EU is very much on a case-by-case basis. The French seem to be very aggressive towards that. The Germans don't like short selling as a rule. I think we might have covered that last time. The FCA is usually, and Gavin, you can correct me if I'm wrong, my impression is they're generally slower to ban certain instruments. For example, certain contracts for difference and whatnot. So the European Union European Parliament Econ Committee is having a session on the GameStop phenomenon next week. And Sven Giegold, who's one of the MEPs on Econ, has said he doesn't really think retail investors should be limited in what they're buying. He seems to think this is a market integrity problem. And I tend to agree with that view. That's what it's kind of boiling down to with the situation in the States with the, what is he called, Roaring Kitty? I always think Hello Kitty. It seems like there are a few instigators behind it. And you know, when I was talking to you offline about this, I called it sort of a black swan market abuse event that nobody seemed to anticipate. It wasn't codified in any of the market abuse monitoring and surveillance systems, and which we also talked about last time. I think it's a difficult one. And as I also said offline, I think some of these people in the States will be going to jail for market manipulation. I'll stop there for now and kind of hand it off to see if anybody else has anything to say about that.
I have some views. I'm fairly libertarian.
Do you?
I know.
Shocker.
Shocking. I'm a libertarian so far as allowing punters to lose their money. If they want to do it, let them knock themselves out. But I get the impression from reading that particular MEP's blog post or whatever it was.
You mean Sven?
Yes. That the consequences of your actions are going to be treated differently from your ability to face those consequences. So yes, go ahead and take risks if you want. But once, you know, if those risks come up, if you suddenly find yourself in a deep, deep hole, then we are going to end up in the typical EU fashion of going, well, these poor people must be protected from the consequences of their own actions. I think the two are, that's where we're going. And they are incompatible.
Well, potentially. Another thing I sent out to everybody this morning was this note that I need to follow up on from the AMF, which I thought was pretty amazing that they're now tracking every retail trade made in France and publishing a dashboard and seeking to understand some behavior, investor behavior, and understanding what people are doing sitting at home with their money. And this obviously was started way before the GameStop situation, because you can't just pull in all that data and publish a dashboard overnight. I mean, or maybe they could, but I think it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I don't understand if it's with an eye to introduce more product banning. The AMF can be aggressive on that, or if they, it's unclear to me where they're going with that. I'm trying to find out, but I found it really interesting in terms of the GameStop news that
generally there is kind of a big so what here, right? There's a lot of things moving. There's regulators doing various things across the globe and lots of political discussion. But I'd like to come back to Gavin on this, because I think if I think about this from a market point of view, it only really matters at the point of the relationship between the customer and its firm, or firms. What do you think this really all means? What's the so what from the change in oversight regime and the any kind of new rules coming their way?
So I think, I think there's something about, and coming back to where I started, I think there is a tension between talking about competition being an unmitigated good thing, which is almost where we've got to in regulatory terms, and consumer protection. So I think, I don't know what the answer is, but I think there is something about, if you're going to really protect consumers, you have to make products safer, which probably means limiting choice, and dare I say it, capping innovation for some types of things. So the more complex it gets, the harder it's going to get for consumers. The more caveat emptor is going to recede into the distance as a kind of a meaningful concept. Mm-hmm. When you can't understand, you can't understand exactly what you're dealing with. So I think there's going to be a real kind of look in the mirror moment at some point. And I think post-pandemic is probably as likely as any in terms of, does all this add up? We agree with all the different pieces of the jigsaw, but when you put it together, it actually doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I guess from a European point of view, when I think about the legal framework, MiFID III, whatever it will become, I think mm-hmm. lots more tick boxes, a lot more annexes, a lot more decision modeling that needs to be done around what's safe and what's not. But Sam, coming back to you, I'm more interested in what you think from a UK common law perspective. What will that all mean moving forward?
Blimey. Okay. So what will it mean, and what I think it should mean, are two entirely different things. What it will mean is that there's a load of hand-wringing. There are some reviews, and there are some post-mortems. Some of the market makers and liquidity providers and the audit aggregators will get a slap on the wrist and some fines. There will be some discussion about the amount of margin that the brokers need to place with the CCPs. That generally business will be made much more difficult for the brokers, as is always the case, increasingly. What I think should happen is very different. I think if I wish to play in a pond where there are sharks and piranhas, and I'm a minnow, I may need to be told and understand that I have to put up significantly more margin, or I have to have lower limits on my leverage, or I'm going to be subject to the market abuse rules and the access restrictions that the sharks and the piranhas are. And if the sharks and piranhas have better order and execution management systems, or better risk management systems than I do, I'm going to have to accept that, of course, my order is going to get lent on.
Rachel, you're a great admirer of the fishbowl of regulation. What do you think about it from the minnow's perspective and the regulator's ability to see the whole fishbowl? I mean, what's the big so what from your point of view?
Well, I think it's a difficult one. It's the FCA, as we talked about last time, is embarked on this big transformation program, and a lot of that seems to hinge on this data strategy, and they seem to think that having more data analytics is going to help them detect things more quickly. It's not clear to me to what extent they're going to be revisiting things that were raised in the Gloucester report, like the call center issue. I haven't seen that on any agendas anywhere. The issue with the call center was that complaints coming in about LCNF had not been flagged or elevated up the line in concern. There was no kind of joining of the dots, even though there were a lot of complaints. And there has been some discussion at the Treasury Select Committee with Andrew Bailey and Dame Elizabeth about red flags being raised there. I think that's a big question to be answered. What can they be doing at that point to improve management information and intelligence? They are having a new intelligence function over there.
So it is not a path that has never been trodden.
Yeah.
You know, back with Peter Sutcliffe and the Yorkshire Ripper,
yep.
The big problem that the police faced then was that there would be a report in Nottingham and a report in Birmingham, and the two police forces would never know that the other had a report. This is
also, yeah. It was also, they were also not very concerned about the victims, who were women and
yes,
prostitutes. So that was a big thing. They just kind of didn't care.
Right. Well, yes. I guess the conclusion from this, guys, is that there's a lot more observation of whatever the ecosystem is that we're looking for, whether you consider it to be fish or people. ultimately, I think that takes us to an excellent landing point. So thank you all very, very much for your review of our UK sausage making or review process, whatever we're going through now. Incredibly enlightening. I think next time what we're going to come back to is this whole discussion of what really GameStop is going to mean then. And if Rachel mentioned one of the hearings in the Europe, there's also another hearing going on in the US. And Bailey even had some stuff to say about GameStop. So I think we need to circle back on that in the optic of the accountability and conduct and culture and supervision, which maybe take us a bit closer to what the way the firms are looking at it. But I thank you all for listening. It's been a fantastic conversation as ever, hard to land in half an hour. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe to Redcast. They will magically make its way to whatever audio service you use. So go ahead and sign up, and thank you all. Looking forward to catching up soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can download the podcast via Spotify, Apple, and Google. But also, I'd encourage people to come to the JWG website, which, as hopefully you will know, is jwg-it.eu. Go to the Intelligence Hub and create your bespoke library.